Alright, who is here today? Wyatt is here today, as is Alyssa, as is Kia. I think she has perfect attendance. Brandon is here today, as is... Wait, Trevor, I didn't think you were going to be here today.
No.
Weren't you, like, doing a fire program, something along those lines? Did you miss a day the other day because we were on a trip?
No, I got locked out of my room.
Oh, well, all right. I thought your name was in something.
No.
All right, so I apologize. Hello, Weekar is here today, as is John, and Cameron is here, as is Tyler. Or was it Tyler? Tyler, were you supposed to miss because of something?
No.
Field trip related?
In April.
Oh, maybe that's what it was. All right.
No,
one of the professors sent out an email, and I can't remember.
Yeah, that's not till middle of April.
Oh, all right. David is here. Brandon is here today. Ryan has been here. Chad is here. And Ernest is here. We got everybody. All right, let me see. One. Two, three, that's it. Only three people have perfect attendance. That's messed up. Three people. So, for the three people, if as of this point, the plus three that gets added on to your final average, and maybe we'll bump it up to five. Three. Three that are left with perfect attendance. And if it goes down to two, I'll bump it up to seven. And if we end up with just one, I'll give you 10.
Am I on
it? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're in the running. But the good news is there's only one person who's missed so many classes that their average is going to be penalized so far. So that's a good thing. Actually, strike that. Two people. Two people. Don't forget, I said that as well. Lamanic gives for perfect attendance, but Lamanic will penalize you if you have too many absences. So, be mindful. All right, we were talking about new imperialism, an attitude that was a development of a whole bunch of stuff that was intertwined, and it all began as the Europeans took economic possession over the world, in the 18th and early 19th centuries, and that impacted the way they viewed the world, and obviously new sciences developed as a byproduct of the Industrial Revolution, and some of those sciences became somewhat radicalized, like Darwinism, because Darwinism would eventually give rise to social Darwinism, and social Darwinism would influence the development of what I call 19th century racism. And when you put all that together, that ultimately was the fuel for new imperialism, the desire in the 1860s to once again go out and begin conquering new territories. The focus was Asia and Africa, and we left off talking about Africa. Now the fear was, as these powered nations were going out and carving up territory, was of course that it potentially could lead to conflict. And so that's what prompted them in 1884 to gather in Berlin and to make international law, rules on how Africa would be carved up. The principles of effective occupation. And we gave you the four standards, the four requirements. And if the nation didn't have those four, possession, treaties, flag, in administration, they couldn't claim it was theirs, which meant another nation could come in and scoop it up. So the end result was this point.
as the European powers began carving up Africa, once they had possession, they sometimes would trade to get better territory.
And or sometimes they would just take stuff that had no actual financial or practical value just because they could claim they could. So the consequence of this was that everywhere they went, they adapted to the situations at hand. So obviously we don't have time to talk about everywhere in Africa. So what I did is I gave you a couple of big zones, and we'll look at some examples of it. Beginning with North Africa. This stretch here. And this colored map, I believe, was 1914, right before World War I. You can see that multiple powers have taken possession of African territories. Now, the irony was, is this technically was part of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans, after Mehmed, as we know, they spread all the way across North Africa, taking possession of it. So what was really going on was not only were the Europeans conquering the native inhabitants of these regions, but they also were taking land away from the Ottoman Empire, carving up another power, making it weaker. Now, how did they get it? Well, they did it one of two ways. The first was economic penetration, which I talked about last class. So they would contact a local ruler and say, hey, we'll invest in your country. We'll build roads, we'll build railroads, we'll build infrastructure. You know, give us favorable terms. Let us create monopolies. And if that didn't work, they used outright diplomatic pressure. In some instances, threatening war to get what they wanted. And war was utilized as well. For instance, the French would take possession of Algeria in a bizarre war called the Fan War. But we're not going to talk about the Fan War because the Fan War took place in the 1840s. But long story short, one of the local leaders slapped a French ambassador with like a fan. And the French ambassador took that as an insult. And so France declared war and ended up going in and conquering the country. So again, we don't have time to talk about every single one, but just remember, they just pretty much did whatever they wanted and no one could stop them. That's the reason why, like I said, by 1914, all of North Africa was carved away from the Ottoman Empire and would be divided up into zones. You have the Brits, you have the Italians, you have the French. This was pretty much sand nobody wanted, but eventually the Italians would take control of it. All right. Now, the most interesting example is Egypt. How the heck did the Brits take control of Egypt? Well, they exploited politics, they exploited history, and they exploited economics. Up until the 1880s, technically, Egypt, like the rest, was part of the Ottoman Empire. But it was in the Ottoman Empire semi-autonomous. So it associated with the Turks, but the Egyptians themselves ruled over their local decisions. So it was more like an alliance. The local ruler, known as a Khedive, was kind of like a governor, technically, a viceroy, but it was hereditary. So it was passed father to son. Now these rulers, for the most part, tried doing good by their people. But as the Industrial Revolution dawned,
they sought to reap the economic rewards. So they wanted to modernize.
So they contacted the Europeans, and they looked to buy or rent out European countries, companies, to come in and build bigger harbors, to make railroads, infrastructure. But of course, they didn't have any money. So in order to hire the companies to do the infrastructure, they had to take out loans. And at the end of the day, if you owe someone money, they control you. All right, last little component. In order to pay the loans, the Khedives began forcing farmers to plant cash crops. So instead of making food, the government literally told the farmers to plant cotton. Because cotton was the commodity that the Europeans would pay big bucks for. So simultaneously, the government is dependent upon the Europeans, and indirectly, the Europeans begin controlling the economy. And who suffers? The people. Questions? Now, the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back was the biggest infrastructure program of them all. The Suez Canal. The Suez Canal would connect the Mediterranean to the Red Sea and beyond. This project eliminated, for the first time in human history, the need to have to go all the way around Africa to go around the world. Because now, you could take a shortcut that literally saved months. Now, the Egyptians wanted the Suez Canal because they saw it as money. They could charge the European countries for every single ship that sailed through the canal. But to build it, the Khedives were forced to borrow huge sums of money. In modern standards, tens of billions of dollars. And then they used the loans and they hired European contractors, mostly French, who would come in and design it and would construct it. So, the Khedive had a brilliant plan, could have made megabucks, but the problem is the cost. The cost was so much that by 1876, 7 years after it was opened up, Egypt was on the verge of bankruptcy. And the Khedive at the time, Ismail Pasha, was forced to tell the European banks, "I have no money." So, to pay the bills, he would do a desperate move. He would sell the shares in the canal that were owned by the government to the European banks, effectively turning over control. Because if you have the majority shares in a company, you run it. Questions? Unfortunately for Pasha, and by the way, Pasha is an honorary title in the Ottoman Empire, he did not even come close to continuing his payments. the total shares that the government owned in the canal was just a fraction of the total debt that was owed. And so the Europeans began demanding full payment or threats of default. If you have a car loan and you don't make your car loan, what can the bank do with your car? They can take it. So the European banks began threatening. Okay, well, our loans built the railroads. We're going to come in and we're going to take them from you. Our loans improved the docks and the harbors. We're going to come take it over. Oh, we put running water in. Oh, we're going to come take possession of your water companies. And thing after thing after thing after thing. It got so bad, Ishmael started saying, there's nothing I can do about it. So the Brits and the French are pissed. They contact the Ottoman Empire. And, oh, by the way, the Ottomans at this time owe the Europeans lots of money as well. And the Europeans tell the Ottoman Empire, fire Ishmael. Remove him. And if they did, they would take a little bit off the Ottoman debt. So, hearing that opportunity, the Sultan said, fine. And removed Pasha from the throne. In his place was Tewfik, Ishmael's son. And let me tell you, the reason why Tewfik got the job, because Ishmael had multiple sons, was because when Tewfik was meeting with the British representatives in particular, he promised he would pay the loans. So this was the guy the Brits want. So in effect, he became a puppet. He wasn't ruling for the good of his people. He was ruling for the good of England. So, to fulfill his promise that secured his position, he increases taxes exorbitantly. Taxes go up nearly 70%. It's bad enough in the United States where you pay the government, even if you're poor, and if you make any type of money, you're paying the government about 55% of your income. So 55 cents on every dollar goes to the government, be it the federal government, the state government, or the local governments. But imagine giving 70%. Well, it got so bad, revolts started breaking out. And as the countryside goes aflames, the Egyptian army sides with the rebels. The army basically threatens a coup. They are going to remove Tewfik and put somebody on the throne that's going to protect Egyptian interests. And the Brits' response? With an invasion. They bring a British army in. Many of the soldiers actually came from India. They land in Alexandria, march down to Cairo, and they beat the Egyptian army down. They put Tewfik back on the throne, and Tewfik remains a puppet of the British government. But here's the thing. This would remain a protectorate, not a colony, not a sphere of influence, a protectorate. Because Tewfik technically was still the leader, but he did things for the benefit of the British government. So in effect, the British government would be allowed to take over the economy. And if you control the economy, you control the country. Now, FYI, England would retain control of Egypt all the way up until 1952. When that year the Egyptians had had enough, would revolt against British rule and would declare their independence. Questions? All right, so that's an example of a protectorate. Now I'm going to give you an example of a colony.
Now, out of all of the tales of the age of new imperialism and the carving up of Africa, what happened in Congo is arguably the most shocking.
In the 1880s, the lands around the Congo River were claimed by Belgium, of all places. Because Belgium, like other European countries, was getting into the colony game. Now, the idea to take possession of Congo was floating around for about a decade before action was taken. But interestingly enough, it wouldn't be the Belgian government that would take possession of the Congo. No, it would actually be their king, personally. King Leopold II. Now, FYI, Belgium was a constitutional monarchy. So the king was like King Charles in England, just a figurehead. And like his mother Elizabeth before him, you know, the monarchs in constitutional monarchies can engage in private business. And so when the Belgian parliament says, we have no interest in taking over Congo, the king basically said, okay, fine, I will. So he uses his own personal money and engages in a business venture. What does he do? Well, he would hire an Indiana Jones type figure, a man by the name of Henry Morton Stanley. Stanley was an English-born journalist and adventurer. So the king would use his money, hire Stanley. Stanley would serve as an agent for the king. And what he would do beginning in 1879 is he would enter up the Congo River and would begin sailing inland and meeting with all of the various tribal leaders that had control over this region. These leaders would then make treaties in which they basically would turn over the land to Leopold. And Leopold would become their emperor. Now, here's the thing. There is no evidence to suggest that Stanley translated the documents into the local languages. The chiefs, chances are, had no idea exactly what they were signing. But under international law, again, we talked about it, if you can get a treaty, it's recognized. And what these treaties did was transfer full control over to the king. And once he had control, he sought to use his territory for his own economic gain. Belgian contractors would travel into the Congo. And by the way, the Congo was 70 times larger than Belgium. Belgium's tiny. Congo's good size. And they essentially enslaved everybody in the Congo and made them work for the government through intimidation, through torture, through mutilation, and yes, even mass murder. this picture was taken after the rule ended. These people look really healthy, don't they? Yeah, absolutely. What did the Congolese have to do? They had to harvest ivory and rubber. They would spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, up until 1905, so nearly 25 years, working for Leopold, who lined his pockets with gold. Now, whenever questioned, Leopold always responded that what he was doing was bringing civilization to these people. You know, that altruism. White man's burden. You know, he had a humanitarian concern for the primitive lives that these people had been living since time immemorial, and he was going to bring them up to Western standards. But of course, what he was doing was grinding these people into the ground, working them to death. Now, because technically it was private property, no one was allowed to go in. Military contractors were actually hired to stop any Europeans from traveling up the Congo River and to stop any Congolese from trying to leave. But in 1902, a reporter by the name of Joseph Conrad smuggled himself on one of the ships, claiming to be a sailor, but he actually was a reporter. And traveling up the river with the company ship, traveling to the different trading stations, he did something that had not been done before. He brought a camera and he took pictures of the conditions that he found. Then, when he was done, he returned to Poland, the country of his origin, and he wrote a 3-part newspaper expose, telling the world what he saw with his own eyes. All of his newspaper stories would later be collected and published into a single book called The Heart of Darkness. It's more than 100 years old, so you can get it free online. But, like all shocking stories, this forced the Belgian Parliament to unleash an investigation. But the king managed to avoid punishment because technically he was engaged in his right as a free citizen of running a business. But for PR moves, Leopold turned over Congo to the parliament. But by then it was too late. For 10 million souls. Of the estimated population of the Congo died during Leopold's rule of the land. One out of every two. One out of every two men. One out of every two women. One out of every two babies. Making it technically one of the first exposed genocides of the 20th century. Questions. Now, by the way, nothing the Europeans did elsewhere even came close. Shifting south, down to South Africa. What happened in South Africa was also very different, very unique. Now, this region had long been known since the Portuguese first came around, found the Cape of Good Hope, and circumnavigated Africa. The region itself had tremendous wealth. Not only did it have, or it had, I think it still does, have vast deposits of coal and iron, but there also was gold and diamonds and copper in abundance. Plus, as if that wasn't enough, this part of Africa has the richest farmland in the entire continent. So, food production, mineral wealth, South Africa had it all. Now, ironically, when the Portuguese, their empire, diminished, and like I said, the Dutch and the English followed, the first people to take control of South Africa were the Dutch. And thousands of Dutch would end up colonizing South Africa. But multiple generations later, by the 19th century, they referred to themselves as Afrikaners, which the English would call the Boers. Now, by the way, Boa is the Dutch word for farmer. These people were like us, if you can trace your origins back, you know, 100, 200 years ago and throughout American history. Your ancestors came over here from somewhere else, planted a seed. All of my family came over the early, right before and right after World War I. So I'm second generation American. But I'm American thick and through. Well, these people were the same. Their ancestors have been there for hundreds of years and they considered themselves Afrikaners. Now, it remained a Dutch colony until Napoleon appeared. And during the Napoleonic Wars, when Napoleon conquered the Netherlands, the Dutch turn control over to the English. And thus it became a British possession. From the Napoleonic Wars all the way up until the 1850s, so about 40 years, England had other problems to worry about. So they pretty much left the Afrikaners alone. But beginning with the Industrial Revolution and in the discovery of iron and coal, the English began putting more and more pressure on these peoples to contribute to the well-being of the British Empire. One of the biggest things they did was force Anglicization on them. They forced everybody to speak English. They expected everyone to wear English-style clothing. They expected everyone to buy English goods. And this applied to the natives as well. Because living amongst the Afrikaners were native tribes. The Zulu, the Shona, the Ndebele. Well, England came in and started telling everybody, act like good little Englishmen and women. And both the natives and the Boas basically said, go pound sand. So they began to rebel. Out of all of the rebellions, one of the worst was the Zulu War, the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879. During that, the fierce tribe, the Zulu, led by their warrior chief, Shaka, rebelled, and thousands of people on both sides were killed. Ironically, it was during the war that one of the worst defeats in colonial history, British colonial history, occurred, when Shaka led an army of 25,000 Zulu warriors, armed with spears, and they wiped out an entire British army of 1,500 men, who actually had guns. After dealing with the natives, then the Afrikaners rebelled. And they fought not one but two wars, collectively known as the Boer Wars. wars were attempts to break away. They were similar to the American War for Independence. The Boas basically said, we're going to form an alliance with the native tribes and we're going to make our own country. But the Brits would not allow that because of economics. So eventually, after years and years of conflict, the Brits would overwhelm the Afrikaners just like they overwhelmed the native tribes. But in 1910, an interesting development occurred. This is the result of 19th century racism. The English had issue with the fact that living in their territory were both the Afrikaners, who were white, and the natives, who were not. And they lived in relative harmony, in peace. They got along. They weren't integrated. But again, that was their land, this was our land, but there was no fighting between them. They traded, they supported one another, all was well. But in 1910, the British Parliament decides, you know, we're gonna put the Afrikaners in charge. Because, well, they are like us. European, white, Christian. So, they established new colonial lines that resulted in this. They separated each of the different groups, the Afrikaners and the various African tribes, into separate colonies. So this would be Zululand and so forth, whereas the Afrikaners were down here. Of course, in between were other separate, although they were joined together this way. Now, technically, each of the colonies were independent. But they were merged together under a single governmental structure called the Union of South Africa. And the Union would be allied with the British Empire. So technically, England would allow them to do whatever they wanted to do. But the way things played out was that the English government would only respond to the government of South Africa, which was dominated by the Afrikaners. So what the Afrikaners slowly began to do over the next several decades is, under the English common law system, they started passing laws. Again, we don't live in a democracy. They weren't democracies. When the government passes a law, you have no say. You must obey. So what does the government began doing? Well, the government slowly began separating the society. The white minority, the black majority, and began not allowing their historical bonds to remain in place, but to separate them. The basis was land. The Afrikaners began passing laws that put all kinds of crazy requirements on owning land. Like, for instance, you had to speak English. Well, many of the tribes didn't speak English, so guess what? They lost their land because you couldn't speak. Or they put it that you had to have legal title to the land. Well, just like the Indians here. The Indians didn't have title to the land. They claimed it out of tradition. The Indians, the Native Americans, they didn't understand land ownership. It was all tribal land. Whereas the Europeans had the concept of, this is my land, that's yours. So what did they do? Well, they began kicking off the blacks off their tribal lands because they basically said, well, you never had a deed. You don't have a deed, you don't own it. Bit by bit by bit, until by the 1940s, a system known as apartheid was created. in which they had a completely segregated society. You had separate public facilities, you had separate social events, you had separate housing, you had separate employment. And it became tyrannical. The whites, for instance, denied the blacks the right to vote because they put property qualifications in to vote. Racial tensions were met with brutal repression and economic exploitation. Apartheid would last all the way into the 1990s. And it only ended when global corporations refused to do business with South Africa. So Coca-Cola, for example, McDonald's, it was ultimately those entities that ended up causing the government of South Africa to equalize society. Questions? Now, yes, things got bad in South Africa, but technically it wasn't under the colonial control of England. Although South Africa today is still part of the Commonwealth. Well, not only did they carve up Africa, but as we said, they also carved up the Ottoman Empire, because the Ottoman Empire was in between Africa and Asia. And what allowed the Europeans to do this was something that we touched upon when we left the Ottoman Empire last time. They reached their height in the 1670s, 1680s, and then after the siege of Vienna, things began turning the other direction for the Ottomans. Now, why did it happen? Well, there are many parallels between the dynastic circle that we talked about in China and the Ottoman Empire. It was too big. There was those six different groups that the sultans had to constantly juggle. And in the end, you had ineffective sultans that would lose control. The biggest problem with inept rulers is when you have inept rulers, corruption, complacency sets in, and then bad things start happening to the people. Case in point, look at who we have as leaders today. And I'm not just talking about Joe Biden. I'm talking about most of the national figures that are in Congress. You know, the people like Mitch McConnell, Nancy Pelosi, that have been down in D.C. for decades. And what have they done for the American people? Do that again. There you go. Put your hand up high. Zero. Because they don't care about us. But at least we technically have the ability to vote them out. So we got an election coming up. We'll see what ends up happening. The one thing, well, I suppose we do are dealing with this because we're dealing with China exploiting our economy. But back then, it was the Europeans who were putting pressure on the Ottomans. So you had inept rulers that were not effectively running the show, and then you had people putting pressure on the Ottoman rulers. How was this possible? Well, similar to what happened in Egypt. Once they stopped going through the Ottoman Empire because they could go around Africa, the Ottoman economy began to diminish. And as the economy began to diminish, taxes went up and people rioted in protest. Minority groups began to slow, I don't want to say ignore the government, but began growing on, trying to grow relations with outsiders. So, for instance, for the Jewish and the Christian minorities, they felt more comfortable being in contact with the Europeans. So it was Jewish and Christian merchants that began bringing in Western goods and flooding the Ottoman market, just like China has done in the last 20 to 30 years. When was the last time you went to Walmart and bought something that was actually made in America? You know, it's all cheap-ass crap that comes from China. But we'll still go buying it because we love shopping at Walmart and on Amazon. Well, when the government isn't going to protect the people, when the government is going to allow exploitation, the people who are trying to take control are going to know it. And in the case of the Europeans, they were like sharks smelling chum in the water. Like they did elsewhere. They did everything they could to fire up internal squabbles, to destabilize the government. By the way, why do you think we've had a flood of somewhere between 10 and 20 million illegal immigrants that have come into our country? It's all of the nations in the world pushing them here to topple our economy, because we can't feed these people. So we are being exploited. We are being manipulated. Very similar to what happened to the Ottoman Empire. And you know something? Our leaders aren't doing a damn thing about it.
And again, it's not just the D's. The R's are just as guilty.
So, with an empire of this size, they couldn't topple it necessarily from within, but what did they begin doing? Taking chunks off. Slices. Little bits on the periphery. But of course, if you take a vast empire and you pull off territory, you're removing population, you're removing workers who fuel the economy, and you're removing taxpayers. So it's like that snowball effect. When a tiny little snowball starts at the top of the mountain and begins rolling, eventually it's going to create an avalanche. So, from 1800 to 1870, you can see the areas in the purple that were chopped off. And then 1878 to 1913, the areas in the yellow, including Egypt, which we just talked about, carved off, taken away. And then ultimately, when the Ottoman Empire in green, this is what it looked like when it entered World War I. And then when it was on the losing side, the Europeans would basically carve off Turkey and would divide up the rest. Which is one of the reasons why the Middle East is so screwed up as it is today. The group who started the snowball were the Austrians. The Habsburgs, the rulers of the Holy Roman Empire. It was during the reign of Rudolf II where the Ottoman war machine was defeated in the Siege of Vienna. The moment he defeated them, he took possession of Hungary, which had previously been a territory of the Ottoman Empire. And then from that point on, his relatives slowly started taking territory and territory and territory, which is the reason why by 1800, this huge section, which once had been Ottoman lands, were gone, absorbed into what became the Austro-Hungarian Empire. At the same time, the Russians were doing the same. There was one point that the Black Sea was an Ottoman lake. But during the reign of Peter the Great, he envisioned Russia expanding, and he dreamed of having a warm water port. So the Russian armies slowly began coming south and would eventually liberate the northern Crimean region. That occurred during the reign of Catherine the Great. Most of the wars that were fought against the Ottomans. And the Ottomans lost many of them. And so when you lose wars, you have to give up territory. But the Russians, being Slavic peoples, they soon would inspire many of the other Slavic Christians in the Balkans to begin trying to break away themselves. 1804, Serbia attempts to rebel, but it's crushed. But beginning in the 1820s, the Greeks rebelled. And by the 1830s, they broke away and won their independence. 1867, Serbia, right there, again, tried rebelling, but they would win their independence. And soon the Greeks and the Serbians began working with the other Balkan countries. The Bulgarians, the Romanians, the Bosnians, the Herzegovinians, the Albanians, the Montenegrins, all of these other people that didn't want to be controlled by the Muslim Turks anymore. Which meant this whole region was aflame. Simultaneously, there was another war that took place between Russia and Turkey and another group of Christians, the Armenians, out here. Some of them would attempt to break away. That's the reason why this little slice there, the purple and the green, or the yellow, would be liberated. So you have these powers coming in with knives, literally carving out lands. It's amazing that the empire survived as long as it did. Questions? Have you ever heard the expression dead man walking? The Ottoman Empire, for all sakes and purposes, was dead man walking. The fact that they would survive into the 19th and then into the 20th century is a miracle. But the primary reason why was because the Europeans were circling and they didn't want to allow any of the other powers to get it. If Russia, for example, took possession of Constantinople, Russian ships could sail out of the Black Sea and compete in global trade. If the English got it, they could exploit the territory, make more profit, which could potentially weaken the French. And once the Germans unified, well, the Germans wanted to get into the game. So you have all of these people that are willing to come in and prop up this dying empire with money, with loans, and military support. You probably don't remember when Barack Obama was president, but when he took office, the United States was in a repression, or not repression, a recession. And what Barack Obama did was he spent trillions of US tax dollars to pump up companies that were on the verge of failing. Big companies like General Motors. General Motors was on the verge of bankruptcy because no one wanted any of their cars because they were awful. Trust me, I had a Chevy in the 90s. Oh my God. Put more money into that car than the car was worth. We ended up taking it out to one of my buddy's farms and we filled it full of lead. The fun way. But what did Barack Obama do? Well, he decided GM was too big to fail, so he gave GM zero interest loans. He took taxpayer money, money that I paid in, your mom and dad paid in, and propped up this company because, as he said, it was too big to fail. So instead of allowing GM to die to be replaced with better car manufacturers like Honda, Toyota, BMW, Ford, he pumped up this company, it's still there. making cars that a lot of people don't want. Like the Chevy Bolt. Wicked side note. You know what the Chevy Bolt was, right? That was one of the first electric cars. GM went out and made like 100,000 of them. But after you charged them, they only got like 75 miles. So nobody bought them. And if you Google it, I'm sure you could find it. There's actually a lot somewhere in, I think, Arizona, where all of the cars that were paid for by government donations were left to rot because they made all these cars and nobody wanted them. Kind of like EVs today. Nobody wants them. They're awful. They don't work. So anyways, instead of allowing it to die, which you should, this country was propped up and it continued onward. Now, on the positive side, there were some people in the empire that realized, oh my God, we're on the verge of collapse. And there were attempts to implement reforms to fix some of the problems. But the problem was every idea was met with resistance. The Sipahi, the nobility, they didn't want there to be any land reform because they would have to lose some of their lands or maybe their tax-free status. The provincial governors didn't want any reform because they had like little mini fiefdoms. The bureaucracy didn't want any reforms because they were in government. They had all the power. Look at what the deep state has done in our country over the last decade. Bad things. So even though there were people that said, yeah, we need to change it, more people wanted to keep it, even though it was failing, like in America today. And similar to America, one of the problems why we can't fix things is we can't agree on what needs to be fixed and how we're going to fix it. Well, the same thing was true in the Ottoman Empire. Some wanted to bring in some of the ideas that were coming from Europe. Constitutional monarchies, capitalism, industrialization. Some wanted traditional conservative reforms. So Sharia law, Islamic rule, militarism, absolutism. And some didn't want to change anything. So if you can't reach consensus, you can't have change. And what do you get with? The status quo. Now, the first ruler to attempt to fix a problem of significance was the Sultan Selim III. He was Sultan from 1787 until 1807. So just at the beginning of the 19th century. He became frustrated over the fact that the bureaucracy, the government offices, couldn't do anything. I'll give you a classic example. Have you ever been driving on any of the highways in Massachusetts? And you've noticed how these areas are under construction? And the construction seems to go on. Day after day, month after month, year after year. And it never gets finished. Well, all of that's by design in Massachusetts. Because our government gives contracts to contractors who hire union workers. And union workers don't want to work. They want to do as less as possible and make as much money as possible. So as a result, we have these situations, and I drive by it every now and then, because I drive on the Mass Pike light. When you get past Worcester, getting close to Palmer, there's one section where the pike goes down into a valley, and it spans over a bridge, and there's barriers on both sides. They've been working on that spot for 4 years, and they're still not done. Drive by more often than not, and then no one's there. But the other day, I was shocked. There was like one guy on scene. And I'm like, yeah, that guy's going to build a whole new bridge by himself. Yeah. That's all part of the game. But yet you go to Rhode Island. Have you driven through Rhode Island? They're like fixing everything. They're rebuilding all their infrastructure, their bridges, their highways. They've got signs up that say this job is on time, under budget. It's amazing. And I sit back and think, how can Rhode Island do it, but we can't? Oh, yeah, that's right, because Massachusetts is one of the most corrupt states in the country. And no one's going to fix it. And we keep sending back the same idiots that perpetuate the problem. Well, Salim sat back and said, I have all these government officials that aren't doing anything. So I want to fix things. What does he decide? Well, he wants to start firing all of the government agents who are incompetent, who are dumb, who actually don't know how to do their job, and replace them, again, this is going to be shocking, with people who actually can do the job. Because he realizes how much waste, taxpayer money, is being wasted on stupidity. You know how much more Healy makes per year as being governor? $250,000. She's a moron. And her predecessor, Charlie Baker, was a moron. We elect morons. They're really dumb. They may look nice on TV. They may use fancy words. But if you talk to them, they really are uneducated. They're just dumb. They have no common sense because they don't care. They're all own puppets. So he comes in, he's like, I'm going to make the government work for the people. He also decides he's sick and tired of losing wars. So he wants to modernize the army and the navy. Because by the 19th century, the European guns, like I mentioned last time, you know, they're using flintlock muskets, no longer the match lit muskets. The Europeans have brass cannon. No more iron cannon. And just the European military machine is more effective. So he's like, well, if we can save the money that's being disappeared, and then we can buy more effective weapons, then we can protect our borders and stabilize the economy. The problem is he pissed off the bureaucracy, and he pissed off the Janissaries. So two of the six groups now hate the Sultan. So what do? They contact the ulama, the religious scholars, and the bureaucracy, the government workers, the Janissaries, and the priests call for a fatwa against the Sultan. They claim he's a heretic. The fatwas, and I quote, find Salim guilty of introducing among the Muslims the manner of infidels in showing an intention to suppress the Janissaries. The guy's trying to save his country. He's trying to protect his people. In the deep state, remove him. He's pulled off the throne and he's deposed. The Janissaries then take one of his cousins, because there is a royal family, you have to stay within the family. Take one of the cousins of Selim, Mustafa V, and put him on the throne. Wait, why didn't the picture change? I don't know. The Janissaries then riot throughout Constantinople. And they began looting and murdering anyone who dares question what they did. Now, Mustafa initially ordered that Selim be spared. But in response to what happened in the capital, one of the powerful warlords who were loyal to the Sultan, Al-Mu'tamar Mustafa Pasha, decides to rebel against the imposter, Mustafa IV. And he publicly proclaims his loyalty to the true Sultan. Well, he raises an army of mostly Christians, Albanians and Bosnians, and he marches to Constantinople to put Selim back on the throne. The problem is, when Mustafa heard that Al-Mu'tamar is coming, he ordered Selim to be assassinated. So poor Selim, who was just trying to fix his country, gets strangled to death in his prison cell. Well, when Al-Mu'tamar learned that Selim was dead, he then pledged fealty to another cousin, Mahmud. And he publicly declared that Mahmud, not Mustafa, is the legitimate ruler. Well, when the vizier, the prime minister, learned of all this, he launches a palace coup, deposes Mustafa IV, executes him for treason, and puts Mahmud II on the throne. Again, all in the same family. Mahmud was Mustafa IV's half-brother. Couldn't put Selim back, obviously, because he was dead. And Selim had no kids. So, now Muhammad's on the throne. What does he decide to do? Well, interestingly enough, he supported his cousin. He thought, yeah, we got to do something to save our country. But look at what happened to my cousin when he tried. They literally killed him. So, how is he going to deal with those groups of shenanigans? The Janissaries, the Ulama, the bureaucrats. Well, he contacts German and the British government and the French government secretly. And he invites them to send military officers secretly to the Ottoman Empire. And then, out in the middle of the desert, they began training a new, modern Western army. Because he realized he couldn't trust his own troops. So now he gets a new army, mostly made up of conscripts. People who volunteer and get paid for their service, like our military. 15 years of slowly building, planning, training. He's finally ready. 1826, he tells some of his loyal, trusted advisors to instigate a mutiny by the Janissaries. So what do? Well, they secretly go into Janissary headquarters in Constantinople and tell the leaders quietly. They learned of a plot by the Sultan against the Janissaries. The Sultan has built a new army, and he plans on using it to kill you all. Well, the Janissaries, who have been that secret shock army for hundreds of years, finds this out, and the soldiers engaged in an uprising. They symbolically overturn huge kettles of soup, soup that was provided them to him by the Sultan. And then they pick up their old antiquated guns and they pour out onto the streets of the city. The one thing the Janissaries didn't realize is that Mahmud had used some of his soldiers and had seized the ulama and literally put guns to their head and said, "There will be no fatwa from you." And they sat back and they were quiet. Well, once the ulama was silenced, he declares jihad, holy war, claiming that the Janissaries are the infidels. The new army, unbeknownst to the Janissaries, had moved in into the hills around Constantinople, had used their modern artillery, zoned in exactly where the Janissary fortification was located in the middle of the city, and they began opening fire. Bombardments of death rain in, killing Janissaries left and right. The barracks get set on fire. About 4,000 of them die within about a half hour. Those people who were out on the streets, the modern army had secretly moved in and there were units blocking all of the streets away from the Janissary fortification. They began opening fire like shooting fish in a barrel. And before you know it, 135,000 man force is completely eradicated. They all were either killed or captured, arrested, and executed for treason. Without the Janissaries, the ulama sit back and like, gulp. So in one fell swoop, of the six groups that we had talked about, you have to go back in your notes, two of them are now gone. Do you think the bureaucrats are going to rise up now that the Janissaries are dead? He's got the provincial governors on his side. And the Sipahi, the nobility, well, they're going to go wherever they think the pasture's green. Oh, and he's got the vizier on his side as well. And when you have control over everything, you then can implement reforms. And this is where we're going to leave it, because I don't have time to cover everything I need to say about the reforms that he would issue. All right. I said it on Tuesday. I'm going to say it again today. Papers, papers, papers. Remember, you're able to get extra points if you can submit your papers before the end of the month. If you can't, no big deal. It's not due till April 21st. But I'm giving you all a chance to get extra credit. The other thing is if you did not do well on exam number 2, there are 2 more chapters in the book that you could tackle to do those chapter review questions. Ironically, the people who submitted it largely didn't need the extra points, but I'm glad they did it anyways. Have a good weekend.